Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
In 1993, following the Great Flood in the Midwest along the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, a White House committee was formed to assess the causes of the flood and make recommendations for improved floodplain management in the future. Led by Gerald Galloway, a brigadier general in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the committee's report advocated stricter land use regulations, increased investment in flood insurance, and better coordination of flood management between federal, state, tribal, and local governments.
This spring, as the Missouri and Mississippi rivers once again experienced severe flooding, the question many people were asking was, why is this flooding happening again? Didn't we make improvements after the Great Flood? To answer that question, we have with us today the man most qualified to address it, Gerald Galloway, who led the Corps of Engineers study, who's now a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland. Professor Galloway, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, let's go back to that earlier report. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of the recommendations of your study of the 1993 floods?
Certainly. And I would start off by saying it wasn't a Corps of Engineer flood. What happened as the flood was going down, as you may recall, it occurred in the spring of 1993, and throughout the summer it was continuing. As a matter of fact, some places were underwater for 6 months. But the White House decided that they needed to know what was happening. And the president himself, President Clinton, said, I want to have a study team put together. I want them to be here in the White House, and I want them to give me a report in essentially 6 months. And so he asked me to put together a team, which I did, of 15 people from all federal agencies, very bright people, and a science assessment team that worked out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, gathering information and analyzing it, another 15 to 20 people. And after 6 months, we reported to the vice president first and then to the president on what we had found. And in essence, what we said, there are several levels, but the first level was, we do not have a comprehensive flood management policy in the United States. We are doing it whenever there's an issue, we try and solve that particular issue or that problem. We build something at that location, but it's certainly not coordinated. The federal government is leading the way. In 1936, there was a Flood Control Act that, in effect, said the federal government deems it a responsibility of the federal government to deal with flooding because of its impact on the national economy and the people of the country. And it is took over at that point in time. It took over in 1936, building of dams and levees in many parts of the country. And since then, people have looked to the federal government to be the leader. In 1968, we came along with the National Flood Insurance Program, which in a way added to this federal centrism, where the federal government was the one that dealt with a community that wanted to be part of the flood insurance program. Long and short of it is, by 1993, when there was a problem, everyone said, well, the federal government must be dealing with that. When in reality, we told the president, it is actually a problem that must be dealt with at all levels of the government, and we need to define those levels of responsibility. What should we expect of a state? What should we expect of a community? And what should we expect of the individual? The second thing we told the White House was there is a problem with the rules under which you operate. They are biased towards building things. The rules that come out of the White House, something called principles and guidelines, had an emphasis on economic development. And in reality, we'd gone beyond that. We really needed to think about the impact on public safety, the natural environment, social structures, all of those sorts of problems. The third thing was the federal government is not very well coordinated. There are all sorts of different agencies, each with their own responsibility. And oh, by the way, the Congress is no better off, and that we really need to do something about it. And then we went through a series of recommendations dealing with improvements to the National Flood Insurance Program, where we should build projects, the need to do comprehensive planning, and on down to some specifics about how you would map the floodplain. A total of probably close to 125 or 30 recommendations.
And to what extent have they been implemented or acted upon in the years since you met with the president in the White House in 93?
Well, the interesting part is I would like to tell you we're there. And it's an interesting story because in the fall of 1994, after we had put the report in, several things took place. The Congress began to act on several of the recommendations at the pushing of the federal government, the executive. And as you may recall, in the fall of 1994, we had the Republican, the Gingrich Revolution. And so the Congress turned over, and the priorities of the committees, this is not a Republican or Democrat issue, it's just that the priorities shifted with the Contract for America, and people forgot about flooding. And so many of the initiatives that were started never really got out of the garage. They were still being looked at in committee. So the big ones, the idea of a National Floodplain Management Act, just didn't happen. It was looked at. The idea of principles and guidelines, so revising those, well, you'd be amazed that in 2007, the Congress finally got tired of somebody sitting there and not doing anything, directed the administration to revise the principles and guidelines to make them broader. And that's in the process. The administration has been working on that for the last 4 years. Coordinating federal agencies, that's still pretty much up in the air. There used to be something called the Water Resources Council that was comprised of cabinet-level officials who had interests in water issues. That was done away with in 1983 by the then-President Reagan, and since then there's been no central coordinating body. There were some changes in the 1994 Flood Insurance Reform Act. For example, it used to be that you could run in just before the flood hit and buy flood insurance, and we said that wasn't very conducive to proper planning, and so the Congress moved it to a 30-day waiting period. You'd have to have 30 days of after the issuance of the insurance before you could make a claim, and the inundation would have to take place after the 30th day. So things like that took place. Probably 25% of the relatively minor ones were taken care of, maybe 25% of the more substantive ones, and then the most difficult ones just sort of slipped through the cracks. It's interesting is that after the big floods in the Midwest in 2008, the ones that hit Iowa so badly, Senator Barbara Boxer asked the Assistant Secretary of the Army to give her a report on what had been done and not been done so her committee could look at that. I know the report was sent over in 2009. I've got no idea of what they've done with it.
So it's an interesting problem as you describe it, because it seems that today and over the last decades, we've seen what seemed to be an increasing number of natural disasters, floods, the recent earthquake in Virginia, the forest fires, extreme weather conditions, and as you describe the experience in reviewing the impact of the floods in 1993, and we're looking at more recent flooding, it seems that it doesn't take very long after an event passes that at the policy level we forget about it and go on to something else and are surprised by the next one. Do you see that in this kind of response?
Oh, most certainly. The late Gilbert White, who was the father of what we call non-structural floodplain management, in other words, dealing with the flooding problem by elevating people, floodproofing their homes, getting them to buy insurance, moving them out of the floodplain, used to say that the half-life of the memory of the flood is very short. No sooner than does the wall dry out and the neighborhood be cleaned up than people are saying, well, it's not going to happen again. And that's an issue that certainly merits attention. But you're absolutely right. These last few years have just crystallized in a lot of people's minds that extreme events are increasing. We had a meeting here in Washington at the National Academy 3 days last week where the title was actually Managing Extreme Events. And we're looking at, are they happening more often? The answer is yes right now. Is it a long-term trend? We can't really tell. But quite honestly, if you look at the words that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has noted, that when we have events, they're going to be more intense, more rainfall, it's going to be brutal, and it's going to cause lots of problems. That seems to be in the flood arena taking place. Are there more frequent 100-year floods? I think that the jury is still out on that, but we are seeing more severe floods more frequently in these last few years.
I think something else you said in your description of the 1993 experience, that it was something like 6 months before the water receded in some places, and it seems that that's very much what we're experiencing in the past few months as well. The stories go out of the news, but people are still ankle deep or deeper in water for a long time after the rain stops.
You're absolutely right, and the 93 flood was unique in that it was the CNN flood. It was the first time if you can think back to 93 with the arrival of network 24-hour television news, that people saw day after day after day for months that people were underwater. They could feel the pain on the parts of these people. They could see them trying to move back in. And there was a lot of coverage. So for a while, there was a lot of interest. But like many other things, it began to fade away. It just disappeared from the screen of things that need to be done. And that's always the challenge that we face with this. Now, the floods this year, we had the major flood on the Mississippi and then followed by the major flood on the Missouri, are two different animals than the ones we've had around before. Certainly, they're extreme events, and that's the challenge. The Mississippi flood of 2011 was very much almost the equal of the 1927 Mississippi River flood. But after the 1927 flood on the Mississippi, which literally paralyzed the lower part of the United States, after the 27 flood, they went and built a beautiful, not beautiful, but to an engineer it would be beautiful, a wonderful piece of infrastructure called the Mississippi River and Tributaries Project. Very solid levees, backwaters, floodways. They provided room for the river to expand in flood periods. And in 2011, when the flood came, it worked perfectly. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. It protected the 4 million people that live down there. It protected the 35% of the nation's oil and gas that's in the southern part of the alluvial valley. Did all of those things. But a lot of people still got wet because in the interim, people had forgotten that there were areas, low-lying areas, that would get wet if it was a very big flood. And so a lot of people said, we have all this infrastructure and it didn't work. It worked exactly as it was designed. People just moved into the path. In the Missouri flood, we built 6 large dams on the Missouri River to control floods, to provide irrigation, to do hydropower, and to support navigation. And they had a plan worked out how the waters would be stored and when they would be released. And there was so much rain that it filled all the dams. And as you know, once you fill a dam with water, it's an uncontrolled flow. It's uncontrolled in the sense that you can't control the volume. It is carefully sent down spillways so that it doesn't destroy the dam or cause problems at the dam site. But the people down below who for 40 or 50 years had not seen high water suddenly found it. They forgot to ask the people that had lived there prior to the dams, did they ever get wet? And that's the challenge we face.
Does that suggest that we didn't build those facilities with enough capacity?
No. I think you put your finger on the challenge that we face in this country. How much can you invest in infrastructure? And how much do you build? Do you build it for the worst possible storm you could ever possibly see? And the contrast would be, in the United States, we have levees that provide 100-year protection. And if they do, then people who live behind them are exempt from the mandatory purchase of insurance under the National Flood Insurance Program. And people in the United States have begun to believe that that's a standard. It certainly is not. In the Netherlands, right now, the standard along the coastline is 10,000-year protection, and the government has agreed to go to 100,000-year protection. On rivers, it's now somewhere between 1,250 and 2,000, and is going to go to 12,000 to 20,000. So it is so critical that they never have a disaster that they're willing to make that investment. theirs is a relatively small country compared to ours. And the challenge is, yes, we could build probably a very big dam, but we have no guarantee that it's going to be perfect. There's always a residual risk. And the flip side of that is everything you build needs to be taken care of. And as I'm sure you know and appreciate, our infrastructure has not been well taken care of. It's not been upgraded. And in many cases, especially with the levees that deal with flooding, they're in very poor shape. And our day after day, levees are being taken out of the National Flood Insurance Program for failing to meet the criteria established by the government.
About what percent of people in the Missouri River and Mississippi River floodplain have flood insurance?
Well, that's a real interesting question. We said in 1993 that somewhere between 25 to 30% of the people that were eligible, they were in communities that had were part of the National Flood Insurance Program, that they had flood insurance. It was interesting that after the 2008 Iowa floods and others in the Midwest, that FEMA reported that 10% had it. Now, isn't that kind of amazing? You have a big event like 1993, and 15 years later, there's less people that have insurance. I was with a group of insurers yesterday in a seminar, and we're struggling to figure out why that's the case. There are some reasons that we have led people to believe that somebody's going to take care of them, that it's really not going to happen, and they just don't understand when you say a 100-year flood, as one member of the legislature in Iowa said, my goodness, we've just had this very big flood. Why should we expect another one of the same size within the next 5, 10, 20, or 30 years?
But that's a really interesting point that you make, because it would seem that perhaps describing the flood probabilities in terms of years encourages people to think, well, there's going to be that kind of an interval between the last flood and the next flood, as opposed to thinking in terms of probabilities. And I'm not sure people could do that either, but I wonder if there might be a better way to convey the risk.
Well, we did a study here at the University of Maryland in 2006 for FEMA. We assessed the adequacy of this 1% standard, and what we said was that 1%, the 100-year flood, is too low a level to have for protecting urban areas. But we also noted that people don't understand it at all, and that either the 100-year or the 1% don't work. Now, FEMA since then has taken that to heart and is trying to sell it on the basis this is a flood that has a 26% chance of occurrence during the lifetime of a 30-year mortgage. So it's a 1 in 4 chance that you're going to have it during the lifetime of your mortgage. That's helped to get the message across. But our study said that it would be much better to use red, green, and amber, or high risk, medium risk, low risk, or Cat 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. People understand when you say there's a Cat 5 hurricane coming towards this city, and they begin to run. If you did that with floods, perhaps they'd understand. The European community has focused on the color system, and people know that if they're in a red zone, they have a high potential of flooding. They also have some interactive flood systems that, as weather happens, as you begin to see a storm coming, they can begin to predict and put out on the internet maps that show for this particular event, these are the areas that are in red and these are the areas that are in amber and green.
It's interesting because we do something very similar to that in hurricane forecasting, where we predict, in effect, the cone within which we think that hurricane is going to travel in the next time period.
Yes. And we can do that. They're making estimates of the flood. I think the flood community, which deals with both the coastal hurricane and the riverine, is trying to learn from the two kinds of events to see how you can better portray the information. And I know that FEMA is working very hard in what's called their risk map program to take flood insurance rate maps, which are simply a plot of the elevation of the what they call the base flood elevation, the 100-year flood, on the ground, and improve that by putting inundation depths. When somebody sees a map of a community and they see that their home for the 100-year or the 500-year flood is going to be under 8 or 12 feet of water, that gets their attention. And I think things like that, and putting risk values on there that include the possible consequences, the measure of what the damages would be in the community under certain flood events, also helps to portray that information.
You had mentioned earlier that over time people have developed a belief that the federal government will step in to help in these situations. And I think you said something along the lines of one reason some people don't purchase insurance is we've all had the experience after a big disaster that the president will come on TV or we'll hear the president say that such and such amount of money is going to be spent there. Do people believe that if they don't have insurance and something big happens, they'll get federal money and they'll be in as good a position as if they did and have insurance? And is that the case?
You're never made whole by the federal government, but many people believe they will be, and they believe that faith-based organizations, other organizations will help them, and they tend to put it off. It's something that doesn't occur very often. A fire engine goes by your house frequently, and so you think, yeah, fire is something I ought to insure against. That's part of it. Interestingly enough, there's more chance of a 100-year of a fire than a 100-year flood, yet I can't imagine anybody would drop their fire insurance, but everybody drops their flood insurance. It's a strange thing that people are trying to figure out why it happens. But one of the things that we keep coming back to is there's this belief that somebody is going to be in there to take care of you. And then the other point is they really don't understand. One of the problems we have is if you live behind a levee, it was amazing to see during the floods this year and in Iowa in 2008, the number of stories of people who said, well, I saw this levee out there and I'm sure they would have told me if I wasn't protected. Well, the levee was to protect against a small flood, a 40-year flood, something that allows the farmers to work every year, but it wasn't designed to protect a city or a community. But they didn't understand that. And I will tell you, as a general rule, public officials don't like to put out bad news. It hurts development opportunities. People don't want to move into an area like that. And in our report, going back to 93, we said it is imperative that individuals assume responsibility, that the communities assume responsibility. People look to the federal government. California in 2007, after seeing this occur time after time, passed a bill in their legislature that says, in essence, if a local community makes a bad land use decision, puts people at risk, and there is a flood, in the past, the state had picked up what the federal government didn't cover, and there in this legislation it says, you, the community, will be responsible for that. And I think that's getting people's attention on making good land use decisions.
So you bring up land use. It seems that's a critical underlying issue that we can invest a lot in technology, but we have a reasonable capability to anticipate where areas are at risk. And if we could inform people and convince people either to stay away from those areas or to add some extra protection in those areas, we might be able to reduce the ultimate costs.
Exactly. You wouldn't, and I don't think any community would allow people to, maybe this is not so, but would allow people to build their homes on the edge of a cliff that has been giving away over time. It just doesn't make sense. Well, there's not a lot of difference between the cliff that's going to fall down and the river that's going to come up, yet people don't consider it that way. And what people fail to acknowledge is the fact the federal government, under the Constitution, has no land use authority. That's all vested in the states and the local municipalities, and yet they're not willing to take on this responsibility in so many cases. And when they do take it on, in many cases, they're willing to let people have exceptions that come back and haunt us.
What would you say are the most critical problems facing the Missouri and Mississippi River floodplains in the next decade?
Well, the first problem that we face is let's get repaired what was damaged as a result of the floods this year. And I'm not talking about the individual properties. I'm talking about the flood control system or the flood reduction system that's there. The federal levees on the Mississippi, the federal levees on the Missouri, the dams. When you have this massive event, you've got to take care of them. I saw on the news this morning the Corps of Engineers saying that the bill for bringing it back to where it was is about $2 billion. The second thing we need to do, and it's amazing, in the 93 report or 94 report, we pointed out that we don't know where levees are and we don't know their condition. that 10 to 15% of the levees in this country are run by the federal government. When Katrina occurred, only two states in this country had inventories of the levees within their states. And we've now learned that there are lots and lots of levees protecting property, and they're not inspected. We don't know their current condition. And where we do know their condition, we know that there's a major budget issue there. A lot of money needs to go into dealing with this. Allied with this is the same problem with the 86,000 dams we have in this country. Who is responsible for repairing them? And when money is tight, repair gets pushed to the back. And so who is supposed to provide this fund? Some members of Congress are saying it's a federal responsibility. Others are saying let the beneficiary pay. That's an unanswered question, and it applies in the Missouri and the Mississippi, because who's going to repair the local levees that were damaged during these floods? And who's going to go in and make sure that in the future somebody is inspecting those and taking care of them?
Much like the water that's behind some of the dams you're talking about, this is a really deep issue, and it needs more time than we have to give it today. But you've really given us some tremendously important insights into a problem that's going to be around for a long time. I hope that we can all work together to keep these issues in view as the waters recede and we go into dry seasons and cold seasons, and all of these problems seem to drift into the distant past. But as you've described it, it's a matter of perceptions and behavior and policy and technology and finance, everything wrapped up together. We really appreciate your sharing these important insights with us, and we hope that we'll have an opportunity to talk about them further in the future.
If I might have one quick commercial message.
Yes.
The University of Maryland right now is embarked for the FEMA on a review of the National Dam Safety Program. And if anybody out there that's listening to this has some views on are our dams safe and our National Dam Safety Program, which has been in existence for a couple of decades now in one form or another, I would sure love to hear from them.
That sounds good. Well, we'll put a link to your website on our podcast when we post it.
Great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been really interesting and valuable for us to talk with you today.
Well, it's been fun.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye.